Hello, I'm James Kamara-Sami. Thank you for downloading the BBC's World Tonight podcast for Tuesday, the 22nd of October. I've been speaking to one of the six Russian military deserters who have been given temporary visas to enter France, the first time an EU country is known to have done that. The former Conservative Defence Secretary Grant Shapps tells us Britain should follow suit. Also, we hear about today's early prisoner release and speak to an ex-prisoner who's gone on to become one of Britain's most exciting new musicians. We'll ask whether the American clothing company Abercrombie & Fitch can weather the arrest on sex trafficking charges of its longtime former CEO, and hear about a major prize for a defender of endangered linguistic species. On a day when President Putin welcomed more than 20 heads of state to Russia for a summit of emerging economies, the government here announced it's using Russia's economic assets against him. The Chancellor and Defence Secretary said that Britain's £2.25 billion contribution to a previously announced international fund for Ukraine would come from the interest on frozen Russian assets. So, with Russian money being used to counter the Kremlin's war effort, some are now asking whether Ukraine's allies, like Britain, should be rethinking their policies towards Russia's human capital, specifically towards deserters from the Russian army. Last week, France became the first EU country known to have granted temporary entry to six Russian deserters. In a few moments, the man who was until July Britain's Defence Secretary tells us that the UK should follow suit. First, though, let's hear from one of the six Russian defectors now in France. Alexander served in Ukraine as a volunteer contract soldier before leaving Russia last year and escaping to neighbouring Kazakhstan, where, as you will hear, he managed to make contact with the French authorities through a network of NGOs that helps some of the estimated tens of thousands of Russian deserters and draft avoiders. He now hopes that France will grant him political asylum, aware that he's a likely target of the Russian security service, the FSB. His replies to my questions were simultaneously translated by one of my BBC colleagues, but we have removed Alexander's voice from the recording for his own safety. On the line from France, Alexander told me how he came to be deployed to Ukraine.
Initially, I was headed for training, military training. I ended up in Crimea in February 2022. And until the 23rd of February, it all looked like ordinary military exercises. But then we were handed ammunition. We were lined up in columns. Our vehicles were filled up, and we then were sent into an unknown direction. Nobody told us that we were going to Ukraine.
When did it become obvious to you that you were taking part in a full-scale invasion of Ukraine?
As soon as we crossed the Ukrainian border, which was a shock to all the military personnel. We had a first stop, and I ran up to my command asking, "What are we doing here?" And he said, "Just wait 10 days and it'll all be over." I had to understand that I was there against my will. I could not have just dropped my weapons and run towards the Russian border. I would have been shot by my fellow servicemen or stopped by Russian border guards at the border.
You say you were there not voluntarily, but obviously you signed up as a contract soldier. Did you realise that this could be a possibility when you were in Crimea?
That's a very good question. In 2021, I had tried to resign from the army. I didn't like the tendency that was in the army at that moment. I didn't want to connect my future life with the military. But we have to understand I was appointed by the defence minister, so the defence minister has to relieve me of my duties.
You stayed in Ukraine until the summer of 2023. Tell us about how you managed to desert.
All the time that I was in Ukraine, I was looking for a legal way of crossing back into Russia. And when you're in wartime conditions, it's difficult to fight your commanders legally because, for starters, you simply don't have a pen and paper. So whatever report you may be able to write, they'll just throw it back in your face. So in that summer, in the summer of 2023, we started getting leave. So when I was sent on leave, I submitted a request asking to be dismissed from the army, but then on the 21st of September, they declared partial mobilisation and our contracts became open-ended and it was impossible to sever them. And I was given a choice. I either go back or they launch a criminal case against me. So that's when I decided that I need to leave Russia because I don't want to take part in this war, which I think is wrong.
So you fled Russia and you arrived in Kazakhstan. How easy was it to escape?
The reason why I ended up in Kazakhstan is because I could travel there using what's known in Russia as an internal passport. I was afraid that there would be problems at the border, but I should not have worried. It took me 5 minutes to cross the border. There were no questions about whether I was a military serviceman or if I had served in the army.
And what was life like in Kazakhstan for you?
I knew that I would be a wanted man in Kazakhstan because there's a treaty between Russia and Kazakhstan on the extradition of criminals. While in Kazakhstan, I met other deserters and my comrades, because they disagreed with the war, were keen to reach out to other servicemen who were in the military.
And tell us about how you came to be in France.
I realised that I would not spend long in Kazakhstan. It was just a transit point for me. I approached human rights organisations and Western embassies, but I was told no everywhere. And then a working group was set up comprising several NGOs, such as Russie Liberté, Take a Hike in the Forest, the Kazakh Rights Movement, and together they managed to get in touch with the French government, telling them that we needed help. So from then on, we worked with the French embassy. At that time, Western countries were very afraid that FSB agents would be sent to them posing as Russian deserters. So these NGOs, they established a protocol for verifying us, and we supplied them with all sorts of paperwork. We told them our stories. We were checked if we had taken part in war crimes, and the verifiers, they included investigative journalists, open source intelligence experts, rights defenders.
How did it feel when you were accepted to come to France on this temporary basis?
When I came to France, I could breathe again. I felt I was a free man again after all that time. I felt that I was a free person, not limited in anything.
But you are a deserter from the Russian army and you know how the Kremlin views you. Do you really feel safe, even in France?
Currently, I feel safer here than I did in Kazakhstan, but I understand that I will not be able to achieve full security. But I have decided to promote the cause of deserters in the media. Well, here I am talking to you, because I think attitudes to these people, they need to change. They've made their choices. They've decided against shedding Ukrainian blood. They are heroes. They know they're facing risks. They know that criminal cases will be launched against them, that their houses will be searched, that their parents will be questioned. They know that they will not be able to come home any time soon. So these people need help.
You said that when you initially were trying to get out into the West, that there was a lot of suspicion, that governments wondered, still wonder, whether people like you pose security risks, could be members of the FSB, could even be war criminals. Do you understand those concerns?
I understand these fears. I understand why the West cannot open its doors to all the deserters. they need to be checked the same way we were checked. If these people are not helped, the Kremlin will destroy them. Even if they're jailed, that will not be a way out for them because they are being recruited from prisons as well.
That was Alexander, a Russian deserter now living in France. So, what should the UK's policy be towards Russian deserters? The Home Office told us that all claims admitted to the UK's asylum system are considered on their individual merits. The former Conservative MP Grant Shapps held a range of ministerial posts during his time in government, the most recent being Defence Secretary, until this year's general election. Asked him for his reaction to France's decision to grant temporary residency to those six Russian deserters.
I think they've done exactly the right thing, and I was pleased to see it. I think there's a bit of a tendency to think that somehow we need to continue with diplomatic niceties whilst now autocratic Russia eats up democracies. And those days, I'm afraid, probably were already behind us back in 2012 when Putin was in London for the Olympics, or pretty soon afterwards.
So should Britain be following suit?
Yes, I think we should. I think it is, I know, diplomatically difficult for countries, and the Foreign Office, I was a Foreign Office Minister at one point, and I know they fret about these things terribly, but fundamentally you've got to decide if we are really on the side of democracy and freedom and liberty and all the things that we cherish, then you have to be prepared to stand behind that when it comes to people like these individuals seeking safe haven.
So when you were in government, what was the approach of the Conservative government towards Russian deserters?
I don't recall actually this specifically ever coming across my desk, for example, whilst I was Defence Secretary.
But if it had done?
Yeah, it would have been exactly the same view. I would have been very, very keen. And I'm now making up a situation which didn't occur, but illustrate the point. I can very much imagine sitting there at the desk of the Defence Secretary, as I was, and something like this coming up. And I imagine that the machinery of government would have been something like the Foreign Office saying, no, this sets a terrible precedent. It could be a diplomatic nightmare. What would be the quid pro quo from Moscow? And probably the Ministry of Defence, and certainly me as Defence Secretary, saying, hold on a minute, they are at war with a democratic neighbour. We need to support that democratic neighbour in every possible way.
As I understand it, certainly the defector we have spoken to was initially in Kazakhstan, one of the neighbouring countries to Russia, where he managed to get in touch with NGOs and through them facilitated his exit and his current entry into France. Is there more that Britain should be doing, I mean, proactively to seek out these people and to help them and potentially, as we've mentioned, to use them for the purposes of showing the Russian people what's happening?
Yes. I mean, look, obviously there are limitations. There are hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of people being sent to the front line. We couldn't do that in a sort of practical sense.
But those who've already left in this way.
But yes, I absolutely think that is the case. And look, it goes to the way that this war is being fought by the West. The reason, as President Zelensky has said to me more than once, that Ukraine is still in this war is, as he puts it, because Britain was there in support and led the way and embarrassed and cajoled other countries to join us. And that is why Ukraine is still in this war. We have stopped being as forward-leaning as we need to be in this battle. And being forward-leaning means doing things differently, taking greater risks. And one of those, I think, should include exactly what you've suggested, but also going further than the other news today, which is that we'll use essentially the interest from Russian assets. Why are we only using the interest? Why are we not seizing Russian assets?
Well, you're making a point here about what the government has announced, £2.25 billion, pounds, as you say, in the interest from frozen Russian assets. Did you do anything like that when you were in government?
Yes, this is actually the upshot of the programme that we worked on internationally to put in place. So this is and I congratulate the government on doing it. It's a continuation of the thing that we set out to do before the election.
So the government is still leading from the front.
So that is really good. That's part of an international effort that we pushed for to get a multi-billion pound fund together. But what I'm saying is that is not enough. That is the interest of these Russian assets. We need to seize the Russian assets. And the reason why that's legitimate, when people worry about, well, what about the rule of law? You know, but that should be suspended in the case of a a country being invaded. So quite simply, if you go and invade a democratic country and you're not a democracy, you should lose those rights in the civilized world for your assets to be protected. And you should understand that.
What would you say to those who are skeptical about actually using the assets, confiscating them and then disposing of them in this way? For example, the president of the European Central Bank, Christine Lagarde, she said, moving from freezing assets to confiscating them actually breaks the international order that you want to protect, that you would want Russia to respect. So it's hypocrisy, she is saying, potentially.
I think she's wrong, and I think it's time to update the understanding of the international order to say that your assets will always be protected unless you go and invade a democratic neighbour. And when you do that, you are foregoing your right to that international protection.
Can I ask you about another story that's been in the news today out of Ukraine? The prosecutor general there has resigned after a massive corruption scheme was uncovered, which involved, well, amongst other things, organised crime groups helping to allow government officials to dodge the draft. Huge amounts of money, it seems, were involved. And it will raise, again, questions about money being given to Ukraine, questions which are especially pertinent in America at the moment in the lead-up to the presidential election. How concerned should taxpayers be that their money is going, perhaps, to corrupt schemes like this?
Yeah. So the first thing to say is, look, I think it's good if they root out this corruption. So it's not necessarily a bad thing that's found. That is good. But the problem Ukraine has is in that sphere of the Soviet era and the way of doing things, they, as with quite a lot of countries that were formerly in the Soviet Union, have this problem of a culture which often reverts to what is the Russian norm under this president. And in a way, it's why it's even more important that we pull these countries into the Western Hemisphere, where that kind of behaviour is unacceptable, where the propriety and ethics of these things are beyond doubt. And I think from a British point of view and a taxpayer point of view, the one thing I was always very careful of as Defence Secretary when we were providing munitions, for example, was to know exactly where it was going and what the money was for.
The former Defence Secretary, Grant Shapps. Coming up later on The World Tonight. Some of the world's endangered languages. We'll speak to the award-winning author who is on a mission to save them. Now, it's been a day of release and review for the prison system in England and Wales. A review of sentencing announced by the Justice Secretary, Shabana Mahmood, as part of the government's efforts to reduce prison overcrowding. And in the past few minutes, she's been explaining to the judiciary in a speech at Mansion House why the early release of another 1,100 prisoners was necessary.
I had no choice but to take drastic action. To make sure that the justice system could continue to function, anything else would have been a betrayal of my constitutional duty, and I simply could not allow that to happen.
So a second tranche of inmates have had their time behind bars shortened as the government tries to free up desperately needed prison spaces. Our senior UK correspondent, Seema Kotecha, was outside Brixton Prison today.
Most prisoners are released between 8:30 and 11 a.m. And this morning I spent a few hours outside HMP Brixton in London. And we saw several people coming out. Some were being released because that was the day they were supposed to be released. Others were being released as part of this early release scheme. And we spoke to several inmates, all very pleased to be getting out, all very excited about what the future might hold. Several actually said to me that they didn't want to reoffend, that they were coming out and they wanted to turn a new leaf. Others were just very excited to see their family and friends. At the gates, there were daughters, mothers, sons, all waiting there to greet these offenders, which is normal. You know, this doesn't just happen with the early releases. It happens with people who are released on a daily basis. So it was that usual picture. I think there was a sense of gratefulness from some people because they were getting out a lot sooner than they should have been. And here's a flavour of some of the people we've been speaking to around the country.
Yeah, it's good feeling, yeah. Got a few months off my sentence, yeah. So I served just over three years. I was supposed to serve 3 years, 6 months.
Well, it's a positive mood, yeah. Everyone's going home, so everyone's happy.
Are you confident you're going to stay out?
I'm 100% staying out.
Yeah. I've served my time, you know what I mean? So, all good. So, I'm rehabilitated, I'm done now. That's me.
So, a few views from prisoners who've been released today there, Seema. So, how did this go, this second tranche of early releases more generally?
Well, these early releases are expected to create more than 5,000 spaces across the estate. But officials are worried that come July next year, the prisons will be full again. And so they're trying to put other measures in place, as well as these early release schemes, to avert that crisis. So, for example, today they announced a sentencing review led by the former Conservative Justice Secretary, David Gawke. He will look at scrapping shorter sentences. He will also look at alternatives to prisons. So things like community orders, serving time under house arrest, for example. Ministers will also increase the time that people can be on house arrest from 6 months to 12 months. And they will look at changing the way low-risk offenders recalled to prison are assessed for release. All of this, as I say, is about averting a crisis, averting the next overcrowding crisis.
And briefly, on these early releases, though, the government is saying no more?
Yes.
Categorically?
Yes, the government says there won't be another round of early releases. But let's be clear, its ambitions are a tall order. What it wants to achieve in a short space of time is not easy. And it knows that it will be judged on how much it can change and how quickly. If it doesn't make a change, well, then we may be looking at the prison system not changing at all. And that, you know, the cells are full and people are spending most of their time behind bars. So it's not got that long to make these changes. I mean, for example, this sentencing review is not going to report back until the spring of next year. And then to implement any changes they want to implement, it could be until the following year that we see anything changing. So, like I said, there's a lot it wants to do. Whether it will be able to do it, well, we'll have to see.
Our senior UK correspondent, Seema Kotecha. Mike Jeffries, the former boss of the high-end fashion firm Abercrombie and Fitch, his partner Matthew Smith, and a third man, James Jacobson, have all been arrested in New York on charges of sexual assault and people trafficking involving multiple alleged male victims. They have all previously denied wrongdoing. The indictment, which went into considerable detail about the alleged offences, was read out by Breon Peace, the US attorney for the Eastern District of New York.
The defendants caused the men to believe that not complying with requests for certain acts, sex acts, during the events could harm their careers. The defendants pressured the men to consume alcohol, Viagra, and muscle relaxants known as poppers during the sex events. And they required the presence of staff during the sexual activity and ensured that the men did not leave the sex events until Jeffries and Smith decided that the sessions were over.
The arrests came in the wake of a BBC investigation which heard from eight men who said that they had been recruited for sex events by Mike Jeffries. The unusually youthful-looking 80-year-old stepped down as CEO of Abercrombie & Fitch 10 years ago, but he was very closely associated with the company's heyday in the late 90s and early 2000s when it reinvented itself as a very youthful and sexualized brand. So can it weather association, the company that is, with this kind of scandal? Joining us to discuss that, Charlotte Hardy, who's editor-in-chief of Retail Week. Good evening, Charlotte.
Good evening.
Let's start with the backstory of Abercrombie & Fitch, if we may. It's an old company, isn't it?
It is an old company. And really, this is the culmination of, you know, an unquestionable abuse of power when Jeffries was there. But the company itself was founded a long, long time ago in 1892. And he actually was responsible for completely reviving it in the 90s from, you know, down on its luck sportswear brand. Famously, Jeffries was behind the kind of sexualized marketing, as they called it, made it very exclusionary, as they called it as well, insofar as, right, let's aim this at really good-looking, slim people. Our brand is for them. We only want them to buy it. We don't want anyone else to buy it. And it was very cool, and it worked in the moment. But it was also part of its downfall, really.
It had its time, and then that passed.
It did. He didn't modernize it with, you know, shoppers' ways of shopping, what they wanted from fashion brands in the noughties. And so actually, much as he was responsible for this rise to fame, he was also responsible for its decline in kind of the late noughties. And he was ousted in 2014.
The company's still going, though. I mean, in terms of surviving this kind of association, this kind of scandal, what would you say?
It is going, and actually it's more than going. I mean, it's actually had a remarkable comeback recently. It's actually upped its profit guidance this year. Abercrombie year-on-year sales are up 31%. Its sister brand Hollister is up 12% year-on-year. It's now a very, very well-run business. They've got all the basics right. Great product, great customer experience, and it's really thriving. Will it weather the storm? Yes, actually, I think it will. I think what's really interesting is that, you know, it takes a lot for consumers to stop shopping with a brand if they like the product. And particularly if that reputational damage is down to an individual rather than an entire company. You know, I mean, people don't stop watching Miramax films on account of Harvey Weinstein being in prison, you know. And I think in consumers' eyes,
I was just going to say, you don't have that emblazoned, you don't have Miramax emblazoned on your clothing, though, do you?
But if you think these are aimed at young consumers, the Jeffrey's is kind of unknown to them, you know, particularly Hollister. Those 14-year-olds are shopping there. You know, they were barely born by the time he was ousted. And yes, of course, look, there's nobody in Abercrombie's head office right now that isn't having an absolute nightmare of a PR challenge, reputational challenges. But I do think, in the eyes of consumers, consumer behaviour changes so fast. It was 10 years ago. And I think they just viewed this leader in particular as being irrelevant to the brand now. That's not to say there won't be challenges, but I do think it takes a lot for consumers to stop shopping with a brand.
Charlotte Hardy, Editor-in-Chief of Retail Week. Thanks very much. Now, the fifth floor of this building, New Broadcasting House, is something of a linguist's paradise. Home to the BBC World Service's 40-plus language services, it's a place where the murmur of Persian and Pashto, of Burmese and Bengali fills the air. But there are plenty of languages which are on the verge of fading away, and you can find some of them in New York, one of the most diverse cities in the world. The author of a book about the challenge of maintaining the richness of that linguistic melting pot, it's called Language City, The Fight to Preserve Endangered Mother Tongues, has this evening been awarded the British Academy Book Prize for Global Understanding. Ross Perlin is also co-director of the Endangered Language Alliance that documents some of New York's least known languages. Before we hear from him, let's listen to some of them. We heard a bit of wacky Seke and Yiddish there. And now we're going to hear from Ross himself, fresh from the award ceremony. Congratulations, first of all, Ross.
Thanks so much, and thanks for having me.
Well, tell us a bit about these languages and where your concerns for the future of them came from.
Of the world's 7,000-plus languages, as many as half are considered to be endangered by linguists, which means that they may not be spoken or used after the next 100 years or so. And that's precisely the languages which are least documented, about which we know the least. All the things that we take for granted, dictionaries, grammars, books, don't exist in what are primarily oral languages. So, you know, this is the work that I describe in the book Language City, The Fight to Preserve Endangered Mother Tongues. And the paradox and the opportunity is that actually speakers of these languages are coming to cities like New York, but also very much like London, as well as many smaller cities and towns, and that there's a real opportunity to document them while there's still time.
Document them and save them?
Well, documentation is a first step. Ultimately, the choice of whether to continue using a language, of course, is up to the speakers, the communities themselves. But, you know, the documentation needs to be there in place for them to do it. But increasingly, individuals, communities are choosing to, you know, to revitalize their languages in various ways and to try to actually continue to use them.
How do you go to seek out these languages, some of which only have, what, a handful of people still speaking them?
Well, the traditional idea was that, you know, you have to go to the most distant island or mountain, and that these are somewhere in the Amazon and the Himalaya. And that's certainly how I began, you know, my work, which is focused on Himalayan languages, and how a lot of traditional linguistic fieldwork has been. But the migration and urbanization that are happening, you know, worldwide, a major planetary event, mean that speakers are here. They're our neighbors. They're among us, and you know, they're in the places where linguists are, where resources are, language activists. And so, you know, actually by sort of hanging up a shingle, as the Endangered Language Alliance has done in New York, you know, which is a paradigm case, but again, is not alone. People have come to us, and we've found people, we've mapped languages, and, you know, been able to establish long-term relationships where this kind of work is possible.
Why does it matter more broadly to humanity that some of these very dwindling languages are documented and preserved?
Several reasons. From the linguistic point of view, if we want to know anything about language and communication, this universal democratic human faculty that every group has, we need to grapple with global linguistic diversity, with the, you know, with all of the 7,000 plus languages, because even the smallest may have something distinctive to teach us about this human language faculty. But beyond that, we're talking about knowledge, art, wisdom, history, all of the things that the languages encapsulate and encode. And beyond that, there are connections to health, education. Mother tongue education is the gold standard. And ultimately, a matter of language justice as well, because languages are not just sort of disappearing of their own accord, but are being hounded out of existence. And so there's a real matter of justice on the table as well.
Ross Perlin, congratulations again on winning the British Academy Book Prize for Global Understanding. Now we're going to return to the issue of prisons, and we have a positive story of one ex-prisoner. Hack Baker grew up in the Isle of Dogs in East London. He served 2 years for robbery in his mid-20s. While inside, he learned to play the guitar, and he is now known as a 21st century troubadour. He's played at Glastonbury and at the Royal Albert Hall. His first album, World's End FM, was named one of the NME's best debut albums of 2023. It contains an eclectic musical mix, as you might expect from someone who spent his youth both making grime music with the collective Bomb Squad and singing in the Southwark Cathedral Choir. This week, a new documentary about his life is being screened around the country as part of the Dock and Roll Film Festival. It's called Hakim, and it touches on questions of class, masculinity, as well as taboos around men's mental health. And I've been speaking to Hack Baker. We began with his beginnings in East London.
Growing up in East London, sunny East London.
It was a desolate place back in the day when I was growing up. I went out onto the streets and found my brotherhood and sisterhood. I was always welcomed with open arms wherever I went. It was supposed to be a BNP stronghold, but when I grew up, I really didn't feel that. It's quite great.
Growing up in East London, on the corner, waiting for conundrums. Every day was a laugh.
Tell us about your early musical experiences, because you were in the Bomb Squad, weren't you, doing one type of music?
But also
In Southwark Cathedral as a chorister.
Yeah, simultaneously, quite weird. So I didn't love the choral singing. I think probably the first place I really felt a differentiation in class. I didn't really get along with a lot of the boys there, to be honest. You feel people look down at you, and you feel people look at you in a certain way. And I never had that, and I weren't going to have that back then either.
I don't get older, just get older. Can't you tell by all my actions? Chop heavy like an improper fraction.
Tell us about, I guess, what was an important point in your life. Not a high point, but a very important point, as it turned out, which was going into prison. Clearly, that was an experience that formed you in many ways as well.
Yeah, definitely. Just taught me how to be, like, super independent. I was very quite independent as a young man anyway. So it kind of just built me, really.
Clearly, one important, very important discovery you made in prison was the guitar, learning to play.
Yeah.
Tell us about that.
The governor came on the wing and said that there was guitar lessons available, and whoever is interested has put their name forward, so I did. And my name got pulled out.
You describe the guitar as a liberation.
Yeah. I just thought, no, this is going to, like, get me away from the previous lives that I was living. I've lived many lives, man. And I just thought this is just going to get me on the one track that I know that I'm going to like and stick to and change my life, I think. And I just kind of knew.
And
passing the message on? Because you've been back, haven't you, to work with young offenders?
Yeah.
Tell us about that.
That's great, man. It's only right, isn't it? Because I'm the man that's been in jail, and, you know, I felt like I've got to do my bit. I got some pain I got to take to the grave,
but I try to cry, but no, it won't go away, no. We're speaking on a day, actually, in the news. There's a big focus today on prisons and stopping people going back to prison, what can be done. Do you think your experience has lessons for others?
Definitely, like, just because you go to prison doesn't mean that you can't master anything. That's a very small, significant part of your life. Probably only made you stronger and wiser. So nobody should use that as, like, a downfall. We should be only use that as, like, a strength. So you only come out stronger, wiser, a better person. So why should you fail after that? Just because the system says you should. You shouldn't, and you don't need to.
And your mum's background, your parents' background in the West Indies is clearly important as well. You've got to sort of tell us about that. One of your songs all about Windrush.
Yeah. My mum is a spectacular lady who made sure I always knew who I was from young. 17. Mummy came over from the Caribbean. And I think with that, she gave me, like, a super advantage to other black working class kids, because what they're used to is seeing us constantly in a derogatory way, whether it's in films, whether it's in music, whether it's in entertainment. My mum let me see from when I was a young child that we've had massive kingdoms, and then we have such amazing freedom fighters and orators like Marcus Garvey, like Nelson Mandela.
Your album title, World's End FM, doesn't sound very optimistic, but are you optimistic?
Oh, that's a good question. I'd love to be, but I'm also a realist, and I can't see anything getting better. So, you know, we all are trying to do what we can to get back to the street, you know, and help out. I just think it has to be us, you know, but hopefully they make it achievable and don't block us. But I think it is up to us, and I think we've just got to make the change.
Hack Baker and the documentary Hakim will be screened at the Dock and Roll Film Festival, which begins later this week. Just before we go, a quick headline that's broken while we've been on air. Donald Trump's presidential campaign has filed a complaint against the Labour Party for what it claims is interference in the US election. A statement on DonaldTrump.com says the far-left Labour Party has inspired Kamala's dangerously liberal policies and rhetoric. In recent weeks, they have recruited and sent party members to campaign for Kamala in critical background states, attempting to influence our election. That is The World Tonight. This is James Kamara-Sami. For now, from me and everyone on the programme, good night.